Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So every year around this time, we put together a gaggle of spring cookbooks we're excited about and, you know, asked the authors to come on to talk about them. Well, this year we had so many, and they all spoke so wonderfully that we actually couldn't fit them all into one show. So we'll be hanging out with some new cookbook authors for a while to come. But today, we've got some great ones. From Poetic Guide to Combining Flavors by a celebrated British food writer, to an utterly thrilling book on modern African cuisine, to a book on how to use the Asian pantry to make super fast, delicious meals, we think you're going to get the start of a great library for the season today. And we're going to kick it off with Lara Lee. Lara is a Chinese-Indonesian-Australian food writer who absolutely wowed us a couple of years ago with her first book, Coconut and Sambal. And that was a dive into, you know, the tropical, spicy flavors of Indonesian cuisine. It's one of the few modern books I can think of written in English on that subject. Our producer Sally is absolutely obsessed with the potatoes from it. Well, Lara is back with a new one called A Splash of Soy. And the cooking in this is as exciting as its title is unassuming. We're catching up with her at an ungodly hour in the morning from her home in Australia. Hey, Lara, it's great to see you. Good morning.
Hi, Francis. Yeah, it's early here, about 4 a.m. How are you?
I am probably better than you are, but thank you for making the time. Thank you for getting up early.
Oh, pleasure.
We're so excited to have you.
It's such an honor. I absolutely adore you. So yeah, it's great to finally meet in person, meet virtually.
Yeah, that's super kind of you to say. But okay, so your last book, Coconut and Sambal, right? It was a deep dive into Indonesian food. It was personal, but full of research. And this one, it's kind of the opposite of that, right? It's quick. The food isn't meant to be totally traditional. What led you to write this?
Yeah, so, you know, when I first started writing A Splash of Soy, Coconut and Sambal had only just come out during the pandemic, mm-hmm. actually. So Coconut and Sambal was released around May, June timeframe. And so, you know, the world was locked in, everyone was cooking at home. But I actually had a 6-month-old when the pandemic hit, and I'd kind of lost my will to cook. You know, I effectively, I was kind of cooking, you know, frozen fish fingers or fish sticks, you know, microwave quiches, constant takeaway. I was just, I think, you know, the fatigue of early motherhood, I'm sure, sure. many new parents could relate to that. And also maybe the pandemic had maybe just kind of made me feel like I'd lost my cooking mojo. So I had to kind of dig deep to say, okay, what's the kind of food that's going to make you want to run into the kitchen? And for me, you know, it's always going to be Asian inspired flavors, mm-hmm. you know, because of my heritage, because of, you know, where I've grown up in Sydney, you know, we're surrounded by a huge Asian community and amazing Asian cuisine. Yeah. But I really needed the food to be quick, easy, and, you know, where I could open the cupboards and say, yes, I've got the ingredients for that. Because during the pandemic, you know, the accessibility to, you know, niche supermarkets and grocery stores was limited. Sure. And so I had to kind of make do with what I had as well. So, you know, the premise of the book was born out of that idea of, you know, feeling completely exhausted, completely burnt out, but needing to rekindle that passion for, I guess, cooking in my own home. And, you know, I'm a trained chef. You know, I've run professional kitchens when I had a catering business. You know, I've cooked canapés for, you know, the Prime Minister of Australia. So, you know, I've kind of been to this amazing place in food. And then I suddenly went to, you know, eating cold peas on a plate and, you know, hard, you know, instant mashed potato. You know, it was a sad place. And I kind of realized how much of my identity as a human being was linked to food. It's such an important part of my life. And when you remove that from your life and you throw a pandemic in the mix, you realize, actually, I've got to refine what makes life beautiful again and, you know, what makes me feel happy and alive. And so for me, you know, writing the recipes for A Splash of Soy, it kind of gave me a great sense of purpose again. Mm. And I wasn't just writing it for me. I was writing it for anyone out there that felt they just didn't want to cook anymore. But, you know, I guess the collection of recipes inside, in the end, you know, they are for people who are, you know, Asian food enthusiasts as much as they are for people who are like, I literally can only boil a kettle tonight. And there are recipes for both types of people in the book. So it was a real joy to write in the end because I feel like I refound myself through writing it.
Yeah, I love that. And I love your approach to, because a lot of the recipes are, you know, this is a pretty quick and simple dinner. Maybe it's a traditional dish, maybe it's not, but a lot of them are just like, here's a great flavorful ingredient and this is how you're just going to make something super tasty with it. And so like I noticed, for instance, tom yum paste. So you mentioned, you know, you live in Sydney in particular that has a massive Asian community, so a lot of different Asian influences. And this like convenience Thai ingredient of tom yum paste, you use in multiple recipes. So normally you would just use it to make tom yum soup, you know, that like sort of sour and hot soup. But you use it in all these different ways. What are some of the ways you like to, well, first of all, describe why you love tom yum paste and some of the ways you use it.
So, you know, I've been using instant tom yum paste since I was a uni student. So, you know, when I could make those, you know, 2 minute tom yum soups. And, you know, tom yum soup is obviously a beautifully iconic dish from Thailand and you can make the paste from scratch. But these store-bought versions are, you know, powerfully robust and really fragrant. And they are filled with like the flavors of lemongrass, galangal, chilies, lime leaves. And so as a base paste, it is spicy, it's sour, it's fiery. Your mouth kind of salivates as you're eating it. You know, it's just one of those amazing kind of combinations of flavor. And I kind of started thinking about ways that I could enhance other dishes using this paste. So I started doing quite a bit of experimentation and I have a chapter in the book that's called Punchy Brunches and Lunches. And, you know, I felt like a Bloody Mary belonged in there. And so I was thinking about how I could combine tom yum paste and a Bloody Mary, you know, and the results are mind-blowing. And you can turn it into a Virgin Mary as well, you know, omitting the vodka. But by adding that tom yum paste, you're getting all of the essence of what a Bloody Mary should be. But instead of using Worcestershire sauce or Tabasco, you're using that spicy, sour, fiery tom yum paste instead. And it is, I mean, it's transportative and amazing. And another application I used it for was tom yum sweet potato wedges. You know, it does what it says on the tin. You cut some sweet potato wedges, you combine it with the tom yum paste and a little bit of oil and some, you know, halved garlic bulbs. And it really transforms the humble sweet potato wedge. It caramelizes in the oven. It adds so many different complexities of flavor and it's fragrant when it comes out of the oven.
That sounds awesome.
So yeah, a side dish suddenly becomes something that you could easily turn into a bit of a main. It's amazing. And I made a tom yum marinade for roast chicken, but you know, often the best chicken recipes require some element of marinating time. And with the premise of this book, I was writing it for the person that comes home and they're like, ah, oh, I've got these chicken thighs in the fridge, but I want dinner
like now,
you know, in the next hour. Now, yeah. So, you know, I made a marinade that you could literally just whack on the chicken and bake. And it's so robust and pungent that it doesn't require any marinating time and you don't lose that benefit. It's so, so tasty. So for me, it kind of, the application of tom yum paste stretches far beyond the tom yum soup. There is a 15-minute tom yum soup in the book and that's obviously such a go-to for us in our household on those nights where you're like, ah, what's in the fridge? Chuck it in. But, but you know, it's just such a great ingredient. And so in Sydney, you can buy it in your local supermarkets. Tom yum paste is everywhere. But I know around the world, you might not be able to do that. But I know with everything being so online these days, you know, definitely order your tom yum paste if you don't have it in your cupboard already, because it is literally life-changing is the way I would describe it.
Oh, that's awesome. And there are still lots of recipes in this book that are more Indonesian inspired. And again, based on these sort of iconic Indonesian ingredients. I want to get into one of those. And that's the jambaran crispy fish with ketchup manis butter.
Yes.
So ketchup manis, I remember when I got my first bottle of it many, many years ago, and I put it on like truly everything. And I kind of overdid it because I've now avoided it for years because I just overate it. But how would you describe the flavor of it? And how do you use it in general and then for this particular recipe?
Yeah, it's like the caramel of the savory world, you know, in my mind, yeah. Because it's got that thick consistency. You know, it's slightly thicker than maple syrup in that kind of realm of kind of gloopy, almost molasses-like consistency. And it's almost jet black in its color. So it's glossy and, you know, it's mysterious. But it's a sweet and salty soy-based sauce.
Yeah.
And it is infused with palm sugar. Often it has, you know, layers of maybe clove or coriander or galangal kind of infused into it. So there's a complexity there as well. In my first cookbook, I kind of talk about people being able to make their own, and I use quotation marks, ketchup manis at home, because sometimes people can't find it in their shops. And if you boil down dark soy or any kind of soy with some palm sugar or brown sugar, you can get that kind of consistency, but you're missing the fragrance and you're missing the additional layers of complexity that you get when it's made in a traditional way. But, you know, in Indonesia, it's a condiment that is everywhere on, you know, on every table. So, you know, when you might be eating soup, you might add a bit of ketchup manis and a bit of sambal into the broth and maybe even a little bit of vinegar. You'll drizzle it over your fried egg on your nasi goreng. You'll drizzle it over your mee goreng, your fried noodles. You know, you'll make marinades and or you'll simmer, you know, pork, you know, in Bali, you'll simmer pork in a ketchup manis based broth. You know, ketchup manis can work in any savory application. If you just made some scrambled eggs, chuck some ketchup manis on it, and that sweet and salty kind of profile is really exhilarating. Like, it's a statement piece. You know, it kind of makes everything feel completely joyous and exciting. You know, it's thrilling, I find, when I, you know, dishes, when I add a little bit of ketchup manis to it.
Yeah. And tell me about the ketchup manis butter sauce that you do with the fish.
Yes. It's almost like a glaze, really. I combine ketchup manis with some melted butter, and then I just brush it liberally onto the fish. So the fish has a marinade, which is garlic, ginger, and turmeric. And so I kind of, and a bit of oil. And so as the fish, you know, once I've kind of crisped up the skin, I kind of rub that marinade onto the flesh side. But once it kind of is pretty much cooked through, I then glaze it with this ketchup manis butter. Mm. And, you know, if you go to Jimbaran in Bali, which is a very famous beach in southwestern Bali, Jimbaran is really famous for its seafood restaurants. So, you know, as far as the eye can see, you know, there are these beautiful seafood vendors barbecuing and grilling seafood on the shoreline, and they are using a variation of a ketchup manis glaze or a ketchup manis butter to perfume and to glaze their seafood. So you get this kind of beautiful ketchup manis kind of aromatic smoke that kind of, you know, very subtly billows through the breeze on the beachfront. And it's a very distinct smell. And you certainly get that when you make this particular recipe. So I can't take the reader or the home cook to the shores of Jimbaran, you know, but I can certainly try to recreate that moment, that kind of romantic feeling, you know, with the sands between your toes and you're digging into this ketchup manis kind of glazed seafood. And it's a very iconic way to eat fish and squid and prawns, you know, in Indonesia.
Oh, sounds great. We'll be back with more with Lara Lee and her vibrant way in the kitchen, and then we'll talk to Nikki Segnet, author of The Flavor Thesaurus. We'll be right back. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're meeting up today with some of the authors of the new food books we're excited about this spring, and we are in the thick of it with Lara Lee, author of A Splash of Soy. Let's get back to it with her. Let me get to one more recipe. It's a potato recipe. It's the sambal patatas bravas. So patatas bravas are like this classic Spanish tapas. They're crispy fried potatoes with sort of like a spicy sauce. But you do it with sambal. So sambal, I think for me for a long time, I thought sambal was literally just something that came out of a jar, like a chili paste that comes out of a jar. But in Indonesia, sambal takes many forms. So tell us about this form of sambal for this recipe.
Yes, I think, you know, people at home may have seen sambal olek in the shop. It's a store-bought, yeah. You know, maybe the Hoi Fung brand. But, you know, in Indonesia, sambal is, again, one of the, you know, Indonesia is very diverse. So different foods and different styles of foods are eaten all over the archipelago. But sambal is kind of ever-present. So no matter where you are, there will always be sambal on the table and sambal will be eaten with every bite of food. It's very regional as well. So there are 352 officially recorded sambal in Indonesia. Oh, wow. But there are so many variations beyond that because every mum in her home or every dad has his own, you know, family recipe for sambal.
Sure.
And it ranges from kind of like a green chili sambal hijau in Padang to a raw sambal mata in Bali, where hot oil is poured over the sambal mata just before it's served because then it releases the fragrance.
Oh, cool.
And then you have some kind of more national sambal, such as sambal, we call it sambal ulek, so U-L-E-K, which is like sambal olek. Olek is the Dutch spelling. And that is, you know, really just kind of minced chilies with a little bit of vinegar, maybe some oil and salt and pepper. So it's a very kind of basic sambal, but really delicious and wonderful. So, you know, for me, sambal is something that has really been at the center of Indonesian cooking. You know, when I was growing up and my Indonesian grandmother lived with me, you know, it was, you know, standing proud at the center of the table. Now, when I was little, I didn't want to eat it because it was too spicy, but, you know, it's always been there. And, you know, for me, writing this recipe was really exciting because in my first book, I think, which The Splendid Table very kindly featured a recipe for soy and ginger crispy potatoes. And it kind of went,
we're obsessed,
you know,
with it.
yeah. Well, all around the world, people were cooking it everywhere. It had this little viral moment. So when I was writing this book, I really wanted another potato recipe. And I was kind of considering, you know, what's a potato that would make me want to wake up in the morning, a potato dish, or make me want to stay up into the hours of the night because I just can't stop eating it. And so, you know, and I love patatas bravas. It's something that, you know, obviously who doesn't, right? Deep fried potatoes, yum, with a tomato-based sauce. So I started playing around with the idea of adding some, you know, chopped tomatoes in the tin to a sambal base and kind of cooking that down and seeing what happened. And the result was incredible. You know, I ended up baking the potatoes because I kind of had Lara, the tired mom in mind, who did not want to deep fry her potatoes.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
I chucked the potatoes in the oven. But the sambal tomato-based sauce, you know, it is rich and full of umami. And it's like something where you dip your finger into the sauce and then you can't stop dipping it. And it's just one of those finger-licking moments in your life. And, you know, then drizzled with the kewpie mayo on top, which kind of adds that other kind of, I guess, injection of, you know, Asian influence as well.
Yeah.
It kind of just takes the patatas bravas to a different place. And it's new and exciting and it's fun. And I tested it, I think maybe more times than I needed to, because I loved eating it so much. And it's a real centerpiece kind of meal. You know, you can have it as a side, but honestly, when I was testing it, I was, you know, I lived with my parents for a short time when we moved back to Australia when I was writing the book. And, you know, I was like, hey, guys, potatoes for dinner again. And yeah. You know, everyone was pretty happy.
And no one's sad for these potatoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Lara, thank you so much. This has been so fun.
Oh, I had the best time. Thank you so much for having me, Francis. Speak to you soon, I hope.
Lara Lee is the author of A Splash of Soy. She left us with a couple of recipes. First, that crispy, spicy, umami potato recipe, sambal patatas bravas. And then, don't miss out on her Tom Yum Bloody Mary. Find them both at splendidtable.org. Nikki Segnit's latest book is a sequel to a reference book on flavor pairings. So, okay, I know that doesn't sound like a page-turner, but it is the most fun I have probably ever had while reading about flavor combinations. And while it's not really a cookbook, it does what all great cookbooks do. It makes you want to get in the kitchen and make something. It's called The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors. Hey, Nikki, it's great to have you.
Hi, Francis. It's incredibly nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much. And this is such a great collection of flavor combinations, but I really just enjoyed reading it. They're the little stories, they're super fun, it's evocative. What do you hope people get out of it? Like, how did you see people using the first Flavor Thesaurus?
So the Flavor Thesaurus is, and the Flavor Thesaurus More Flavors are reference books, which are treasuries of flavor combinations. And I suppose the way that I would hope people use them is that they use them as inspiration. You know, the idea is that they're jumping off points and they kind of, along the way, they teach you about flavor. They teach you about an ingredient's flavor. They get you thinking about certain matches. And hopefully they do that in quite an entertaining way.
They are definitely entertaining. The book is organized in these evocative categories. Like one of them is sweet, starchy. And so you have ingredients that have a sort of sweet, starchy character or an herbal category. And then within each category, you have all these ingredients that go there. And then each of those ingredients, you pair with something and you write a description of that pairing. And so some of the combinations are really well known, but others aren't as much, I think. Like carrot and seaweed is not something I've really thought about together. So how did you go about putting these combinations together?
Sure. I mean, firstly, with extreme patience and quite a lot of time. the first book took 3 years and the More Flavors took 4 years. So what I do is I draw up a list and then it's almost like having a grid. So I think the first book is 99 ingredients. And what you're doing is you're making a grid of 99 by 99 and you go through them one by one and you assess each one of them as a pair. I mean, somebody once suggested this and I thought it was a great idea that it's like sitting in Italy, watching the passaggiata of couples walking along and commenting on all of them or saying something about it or trying to analyze why they go together. And I think that's really lovely because the book is a bit like that. It takes, you know, lots and lots of refining, lots of working in circles, loads of research, loads of like drawing on lots of other people's opinions. So it's not just, you know, it's not my subjective view alone. That would be a very strange book. But, you know, it's just like refining until you get down to understanding which are the most interesting, which are going to impart something to the reader that either inspires them or teaches them or, you know, just kind of perhaps has a bit of a strange clue in there to kind of get their brain working. It's really, it's very much about creativity. You know, even you might be two-star chef somewhere, but you might also be somebody who just really loves cooking. It's got half a cauliflower that's starting to, you know, need using up in the fridge. And it's, but they have the same need, which is like, make me excited about using this. Make me excited sure. about this ingredient.
Sure, sure, sure. I remember, you know, there's one for chives and yogurt, which of course are going to be delicious, right? But then there's some surprising ones. What are some of your favorite surprising combinations?
Well, I was having a flick through today for something else, and I came across one that kind of stopped me, and it was rye and cranberry. Mm. And in fact, rye is not a flavor that I knew a lot about until I did the research. And what an exciting flavor it is in a way, because it's so flavorful, and it's so, in a way, it's quite a serious, quite a heavy flavor. It's really quite, I don't know, something rather intellectual about rye. You feel like it is kind of weighty and serious, and then matched with cranberry, which is, I don't know if you've ever tasted a raw cranberry.
It's
a bit like,
it makes your face go
it completely makes your face go like that. And also you might find that it's quite hard to find much flavor in there. And it's got a texture of a bit like a raw potato. It's very kind of, it's got the sort of crisp cellulose crunchiness.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously we don't eat a lot of, and we shouldn't eat a lot of raw cranberries. But cooked, came across this Latvian dessert of rye crumbs and cranberries, because obviously cranberries are a cold weather fruit.
Okay.
And then I got into that, and looking into how rye is also, you know, rye vodka. The first time that Finlandia made a flavor, they made cranberry flavor. And there's lots and lots of different places. I love finding these echoes of how an ingredient, ingredient pairing that I didn't particularly know. And then I found, it comes in this format and this format and this format. And the rye and cranberry dessert, as I say, it's Latvian. It's rye crumbs, and they're kind of mixed with sugar, and then there's some sour cream in there and a cranberry compote. Quite simple, but the two flavors together, they just got they've got a cold weather wildness about them that comes together really beautifully, particularly with the sour cream. Highly recommended.
That's very cool. What's another surprising combination that you love?
The funny thing about surprising is, I'm sitting here in the UK, and what is surprising to me might not be surprising to you. So I'm going to try this out on you. What about maple syrup and fennel?
Well, tell me more.
Well, so, maple syrup has its own flavor wheel. So it makes it quite an easy ingredient to research in comparison to a lot. So some of the research has already been done, like at least the analyzing of what kind of flavors make up maple syrup. But in my work, I'm looking to see what maple syrup has historically been paired with, what it's being paired with now. And then kind of thinking, I don't know about for you, it's expensive here. You know, a little bottle of maple syrup is £6 or like $8, $9.
Yeah.
And you don't want to pair something that's that special with something that's not going to do real justice to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in all of my experiments, I think the thing that did the most justice to it was fennel seeds. Just a very small amount, just picking out a very natural fennel note in the syrup. And here in the UK, we have something called golden syrup. I don't know if you've ever come across it.
I have read so many recipes for golden syrup cakes and golden, and I've always wanted to try it, but I've never gotten my hands on it. What is it?
Okay, well, it's a byproduct of sugar refining.
Okay.
And it is like, it's very thick. It's golden honey coloured. And what's unusual about it is it tastes richly sweet. It's got a slight toffee flavour, but it's got citric acid in it. And it tastes lemony. And in fact, if you put lemon in maple syrup, it tastes like golden syrup. And you don't want to do that, because golden syrup is about £1.50 a bottle. But
you may, how to instantly devalue your maple syrup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's how to completely wreck maple syrup. Yeah. But we make a tart here called treacle tart. It's got nothing to do with treacle. It's made with golden syrup with lemon in it. And it's really great, because the lemon kind of highlights that citric flavor that's naturally in the syrup, but also stops the sweetness being too insistent and too boring. Now, if you do the same thing with maple syrup, just use a very small amount of fennel seed. It does the same. It just picks out a natural flavour note in there in a nice way without ruining all the others. But it brings in a freshness that that kind of amount of sugar and sweetness really needs. It's absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I do develop some of my own recipes for the book. It's not, I'm not a chef, and it's not something that I would say that's my major strength, but it is one of the recipes in the book that I think, oh yeah, this is really great. I really recommend people try this because it's a way of pairing maple syrup that's worth it.
Mm. Very cool. You mentioned the golden syrup, how it looks like honey, and it reminded me of a combination you had in there that on some level seems, I don't know, it could be very surprising for someone, it could be very obvious for someone, but avocado and honey, which is not something I've ever put together before.
No, I mean, I hadn't either. And in fact, I have a Brazilian friend, and to her, it would be the most natural thing in the world to eat avocado with either, you know, with some sugar sprinkled on or some honey put on it, you know, to eat it as a dessert. You know, it's a fruit. Why wouldn't you eat it like a fruit? To me and to my compatriots, most avocado is eaten as guacamole.
Sure.
Or in a sandwich or something like that. So when I stirred some honey, I put some very light honey in it because obviously honey covers a very, very broad spectrum of flavor variations.
Yeah, for sure.
But so I use something like orange blossom honey, which is very, you know, very light, just has a very, very mild version of that kind of that flavor that all honeys have that tastes a bit like chamomile. And took the first spoonful of it, and it was just, I just instantly got this feeling that it was like going back to a house or apartment that you used to live in but don't anymore. It's like so familiar and yet so strange, because it's picking out those flavors that you kind of know, that very delicious buttery grassy flavor is suddenly presented to you in a sweet guise rather than a savory guise or a neutral guise. And yeah, it's like, I don't know if you ever sucked on the tip of a blade of grass when you're a kid, or maybe as an adult, I don't know.
No.
Or a piece of clover. If you pick a piece of clover and just suck the bottom of it, it's just, it's got this beautiful, sweet, grassy flavor. And that's what the avocado is like. And it's, this is one of the things I love about the book, is that you know, it takes you through all these ingredients and says, you know, this will bring out this kind of aspect in it, or have you tried it like this, or have you got to know it like this? It's like getting to know somebody and getting to know all the sides of their character.
And that's one thing I really love about this book too, because if you were to describe this book to me, I would have immediately thought, oh, it's going to like go into all the, you know, the chemical components of, you know, this ingredient and that ingredient. The reason why these two things go together is because they share this molecule or whatever, which, you know, is a real thing. But it's such a joy to read because it's not that, you know, there's elements of that, but it's as much about the evocativeness or the feelings that you get from a certain ingredient or a certain experience. And it's such a lovely approach to the idea of flavor in cooking.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just good to mix it up. I mean, you know, sometimes a flavor combination evokes something romantic. Sometimes it's something quite funny. Sometimes it's like you say, sometimes it is flavor science because the molecules are really relevant and what there is to say about it will be useful. You know, that the idea is always that someone not only just reads the entry about that particular pairing, but they, you know, maybe it gives them something to take away to use in their cooking more broadly.
Yeah, it's not every moment that you can take a thesaurus or something called a thesaurus and use it as a place of inspiration, not just reference.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Is Roger's thesaurus a thing in the States?
I mean, I think I still own one somewhere.
Yeah. You know. I mean, I know when I went to buy one, a new one, when I first was starting to write the flavor thesaurus, I thought I'd go and buy a proper one in a really good bookshop. And now they only sell A to Z thesauruses. So you don't get Roger's brilliant organization, which was organized by philosophical themes. Mm. And the flavor of the thesaurus is based on Roger's. The idea is like the back has got a list of what goes with what that you can quickly reference if you're just kind of like, oh, I've got a soup. What do I throw in with it to make it more interesting? But like Roger, the, you know, the exciting bit's in the front. It's the elaboration. It's the bit that you turn to when you kind of want to be taken away a bit. That's the, you know, the creative point is no, actually, you know, actually when you're reading Rose Chase and you think you want one word and you turn to the front and it says something and you think, oh no, that's actually, it's much closer to what I meant, or that would be a more interesting take on what I meant. And I suppose that is the kind of slightly more chefy side of the book, or the kind of, if you like, the really keen cook, it's where it kind of, it takes you somewhere different. I mean, people have said, you know, it's like a choose your own adventure book in that respect. You know, like you think you're going somewhere and then you kind of end up in a completely different place. And, you know, what more could you want in life?
No, exactly. Well, I love that. I love the idea of the flavor thesaurus as adventure. Well, thank you so much, Nikki. This has been such a blast.
Thank you very much for having me on the splendid table. It's been a real treat.
Nikki Segnant is the author of The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors. Coming up, Lerato Umashaler, author of Africana, an amazing tour through the foods of that rich continent. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Well, this next book, Africana, came out recently here in the States. It was originally released last year in the UK, where it snagged a bunch of honors and awards for being one of the best cookbooks of the year. Its author, Lerato Umashaler, treats foods from all over her native Africa with love and care, but never gets precious about them. And she thinks all that sharing is worth doing only if people are going to really go and cook the food. So her recipes are approachable, they're delicious, they're both traditional and modern, and they are geared for people to enjoy African flavors any night of the week. Hi, Lerato. It's great to see you.
Hi, Francis. Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, we are more thrilled. And I love your book. It's beautiful. The food looks terrific. And it's such a fun book. Like, I love finding out that an Ugandan Rolex is the name for a dish of rolled eggs. Like, that's amazing. So, but you grew up in Nigeria.
Yes, I did. But
from an early age, you said you started identifying as an African as much as a Nigerian.
Yes.
You felt connected to the larger continent.
Yes.
Tell us why and what does that mean to you?
I think as a child, not really knowing what that meant to me per se, it started from my mom just being like a world traveler. My mother loved traveling.
Okay.
Whenever we'd go out, people would assume she was South African. And I think simply because she had this shaven head and she was of what you call traditional build. So it's a very typical look in South and Southern Africa. So people always assumed we were foreigners wherever we went. And my mother would travel across different African countries. And that just really inspired me. I was really like excited to be like her, you know, and travel around and experience new things and eat all this wonderful different food. And as I grew up, she started to feed us that lifestyle as well, living in several different places. Like we lived in Benin, Republic of Benin. We were always sort of like, when people say things like, when did you move here? Which is the UK. I'm like, well, I can't, there's no real recollection of when I moved. We were always back and forth until after university. Then as an adult, I started living here properly. So from childhood, I've always felt connected to the continent as a whole. And I think it's because I was exposed to a lot of it. I became attached to a lot of it from friends, family, those experiences that I had from my mom traveling and from us traveling just never left me.
yeah. And it is really incredible, like the diversity. I mean, obviously, it is a massive continent with literally billions of people living in it, and you know, many different cultures, cuisines, geographies, terrains.
Yeah.
And I love that you want to embrace all of it.
Yes, and why not? I feel like another reason why I felt very passionate about embracing it was, for me, it wasn't enough to just sort of celebrate and champion Nigeria. Especially because of what I saw in the West and the rest of the world. Africans were not necessarily seen as... I mean, it's very different now because of our music, fashion. But for a while, Africans were always at the bottom of the pile in conversations, in politics, in every single sort of facet of the world that you look at. We were always sort of ignored or regarded to be the least... a continent that you expect tragedy and poverty and not much else, you know? When an African is creative or intelligent, it's like, oh my God, imagine that. You know, so I saw that as a child, especially from traveling to different countries across the world. And I just always felt I was special. I felt Africans are special. I've grown up enjoying learning special things. And I just started harnessing this desire to want to show everyone exactly what they're missing.
Yeah.
And it just happened to be food.
Yeah. Well, actually, but you weren't trained in food originally. You went to university, you were trained in economics.
I studied economics.
And actually, you wrote that your family was surprised when you turned to food professionally. Why did you do that?
Yeah, so my choice for economics was also the same reason. I wanted to... try to be part of the people that were trying to close the north-south divide. So that's why I studied economics. I thought if I learn about the economy and why things are the way they are, maybe I can participate in policy creation. I always believed if I was part of policy creation, then I can start to make change. But I became disillusioned with international organizations. And I just felt, you know, even the African countries themselves are playing a lot of politics. You know, countries play politics with people's lives. And I thought, oh, gosh, this is so difficult. And then I chose what seemed to be the easy route, which, of course, is not. It looks, you know, like I'm having fun and it's just cooking, you know, it's just food.
But
and then I just sort of stumbled into cooking. Actually, that's wrong. As a child, I loved cooking. We had a chef growing up and I was very inquisitive. I'd go to the kitchen, he'd show me things. My mother also made sure that she taught me a lot of recipes before I left home. She knew the kind of life I was going to have. I think she always prepared me for this sort of like living everywhere and nowhere type lifestyle. So she just always thought, I need to teach you how this is made, where the food comes from. You need to go to the market. You need to know these things so that it's not alien to you. And by the time I left home...
And you have a grounding.
Exactly. That was really important. By the time I left home and started this, went on this dream to study economics and, work for international organizations, that grounding never left me. So when I moved into food by chance, because I loved cooking, so I would always cook. You know, I'd go to a restaurant, come back home and cook. And then I just fell into it, you know, as a job. I got one opportunity on the telly in Nigeria, and then on the radio, and then in magazines, newspapers. And then it just started to dawn on me that I was very good at this. Here we are.
Yeah, right on. Well, congratulations. And reading your book, I love that you have some of the traditional dishes that, you know, people who are maybe only just learning about African food or maybe only have some experience with African food, but not a lot, would know, like chicken yassa from Senegal. So like that's there. But then you have these spins too, these sort of modern takes on it. Like you take that and make a yassa butter sauce with lamb chops. So first, tell us about the yassa butter and how you make it and what is it like?
So the yassa butter, I mean, it's sort of a riff on like butter chicken. You know, it's just that sort of idea of thickening a sauce with, cream or butter. And in the yassa, I create yassa, which for those who don't know what yassa is, it's a tangy, I call it sunshine on a plate. It's a tangy Senegalese dish, also made in Gambia. And it's with caramelized onions and mustard and citrus and chili. So it's spicy, it's tangy, it's warm, it's delicious. It's literally sunshine on a plate. And I have pule yassa, which is like your typical chicken yassa in the book. And then I thought, you know, I've always enjoyed the asa in several different ways. So whenever I make it at home, you end up with leftover sauce. Maybe you finish the chicken and you still have sauce left. And then I started whizzing the sauce into like a puree. So for this recipe, I add carrots. So the carrots sort of increase the sweetness of the dish and also creates like a really nice silky texture and thickness to the dish. So we add a little bit of cream just to create that butter effect, because churned cream is butter.
Sure.
Add a little bit of cream, a little bit of carrots. You don't actually even have to add the cream, to be honest. And then we make the asa with carrots and whiz it up into a really smooth, silky sauce. And there's nothing to it, really. You've made the asa. You have extra veggies. It could be mushrooms. It could be carrot. But that was just taking that recipe a step further than what we know it to be. And this is what I do a lot in Africana. So we'll have traditional recipes to honor and celebrate and to give people context, which I think is very important, especially if you don't know the cuisine. And then we move forward with showing you how you can take this a little bit further, you know, to food that goes beyond just being of African origin to just being great food.
Yeah, sure. I love that what you said to me the other day, too. It's like it's modern cooking, but modern cooking doesn't equal Western cooking.
Yes, because I've
also just modern.
Yeah, because I've had some people quite rightly they're being complimentary about some of my recipes, and they say, oh, this is so good, you know, they're congratulating me for doing well for the Western palate. And I'm like, I didn't write this book for the Western palate. I wrote the book for cooks across the world, for everyone. It wasn't toned down for a certain people. The flavors are big, bold, and amazing, but the point is the modern recipes are modern African recipes. Africa can also be modern. Modern doesn't mean Western. Africa is also a modern society. We're not backwards. We're modern like everyone else.
Yeah. Well, another one I want to ask you about is the akara.
Yeah, akara.
The black-eyed pea fritters.
Yeah.
And, you know, black-eyed peas originate in Africa, I believe, and have traveled. You know, so tell us about this fritter and where you see the sort of legacy of it.
So akara is one of those great dishes that sort of celebrate the threads. I have these stories in the book that talk about the threads that bind us as humans, first of all, threads that bind us as Africans within Africa and outside Africa. So everyone of African descent, you know, across the world. I think sometimes using the word diaspora might even be too limiting. If your blood and heritage is of African descent. akara is one of those dishes that, you know, it's really popular in Yoruba culture. And it's one of those recipes that you can find quite phenomenally in a place like Brazil. Really, really loved in Bahia, El Salvador. And it traveled across Africa with people. It traveled with the slaves. You know, these dishes, the black-eyed peas as a produce, akara as a dish and the traditions and culture behind it traveled with the people that it went with as slaves. And it's just interesting to see how something like that so strongly can still be part of people's identity and society. And the ingredient itself, black-eyed peas, we see it in so many cuisines across the world, especially in America, you know,
for sure.
In the new year, you celebrate with black-eyed peas, you know, you use it as a sort of symbol of prosperity and good luck.
Sure, yeah, Hoppin' John, yeah.
You know, for Juneteenth as well, you have lots of different recipes where you use and celebrate black-eyed peas. All these things are not singular celebrations that came out of America. They transcended from the African culture and the African people to these other parts of the world.
Yeah, it's terrific. Well, let's get back to the akara, though. Describe a good one and what it tastes like, and how do you make it?
So akara is, typically it's with black-eyed beans. In America, you say black-eyed peas, and they're typically washed. I remember my mother taught me how to wash them. You wash them and peel the skins off. Very difficult. You have to soak them first overnight, or at least for a good few hours, and then wash them. And as you're washing, you're peeling off the brown skins and the black eye. There's an actual black eye connecting the skin to the white bean. And we peel that off. Now there are modern ways. You can just pop it in a blender with a little bit of water and pulse, you know, and that's modern cooking. A lot of us now know how to make things quicker. So you blend the beans into a fine puree with peppers, sometimes crayfish, quite commonly red oil, palm oil, some spices, some chilies, you know, scotch bonnets, and sometimes a bouillon cube or, you know, some kind of stock. So nice, flavorful, strong, into a nice, really thick puree. And then you use your spoons, or sometimes people have this hand action that they use to sort of scoop the batter into hot oil, and then you fry it. So the outside tends to be a little bit crispy, depending on how soon you're eating it. If you're eating it fresh out of the pot, it can be a bit crispy on the outside and really nice and fluffy inside. Wonderful, sort of like a substantial treat. It can be, you can actually even stuff it in bread. In Senegal, they eat akara in baguettes, you know, with salads. Mm. In Nigeria, we would eat it on its own with some chili dip, with like a spiced scotch bonnet dip, you know. In Ghana as well, they eat it similarly. I keep saying we, you know. I literally regard myself as somebody from everywhere. we. so it's a lovely, lovely dish that's quite healthy as well, you know, as it's just beans and spices.
And actually, there's a dish I was really intrigued by. You call it a bejeweled aromatic fried rice. I was intrigued by it because it's, well, fried rice, but it's flavored with curry powder.
Yes.
And you say it's a classic of Nigerian cooking.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there are lots of influences here. Tell us about that dish.
Yeah. So that's a classic that, for me, I actually, growing up, I preferred fried rice to jollof rice. My mother cooked fried rice all the time. And the reason I named it Bejeweled as well, because that's how I remember it, like this really glistening dish with lots of different colorful jewels of green beans, green peas, carrots. She actually used to put some diced kidney liver as well, you know, and then prawns.
Oh, I love that.
And it's a dish that you would find at weddings and parties, you know. And I believe this sort of, I believe this tradition may have come from either Nigerians just loving Chinese food, even though we don't put soy sauce as a typical, it's not a, you can do as a sort of salt, you know, for that salty effect. But we use curry powder more often. I believe this might also be influenced from the Senegalese cooking of a lot of Vietnamese food.
Interesting.
Because a lot of the recipes that we have, except yassa, yassa is not something that we cook in Nigeria, but we cook jollof rice, which came from Senegambia. And we cook so many other different chili sauces and dips that are quite similar. We cook akara. We all cook the same, you know, the same kind of akara. But that fried rice dish is so uncharacteristic of cooking in Nigeria, you know, which is also very different across the board and across the country. So I'd say it's one of those things that I can't tell you who started this or why.
But it's just like iconic, even though it's not super clear where it came from.
Yeah, fried rice. Ask anyone, any Nigerian friends you have. At a party, you'd see jollof, you'd see fried rice, you'd see samosas, you'd see spring rolls. Spring rolls is not Nigerian. But it's a classic. We call it chops, you know, the little bites. Not canapes, but more like the snacks you'd see at parties.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the fried rice, yeah, it's a classic in Nigerian cooking. I thought it was one that people might wonder, like, what's fried rice doing in it? And it caught your attention, so that's good.
Well, for sure. Well, it is. It's fried rice might be the thing that brings the world together. But
yeah.
This has been super, super fun. I love this book. And thank you so much for coming by, Lerato.
Thank you so much for having me, Francis. Bye-bye.
Lerato Uma-Shaler is the author of Africana, more than 100 recipes and flavors inspired by a rich continent. You can find a recipe for akara, bean fritters with ginger and spring onions, at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Like I said, we couldn't fit all the books we wanted to talk about, so you just have to keep coming back. Talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman is our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetta Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your downloads. Take some time to leave us a review. Want to hear what you think? I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.